You are listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, a series featuring students reading the works they've created in and out of class.
You're listening to Off the Page here at 88.5 WRKC. I'm Noreen O'Connor, and I'm your host today. I'm an English department faculty member here at King's College, and I'm bringing you the stories written by King's College students this last spring after they did some work at the Luzerne County Historical Society archives with Tony Brooks. I had an opportunity to sit down with Tony Brooks and talk about this project recently, and one of the things he stressed was the importance of looking at original documents for students. It helps them bridge the gap between the history of the past and their own understanding of it today.
In most historical societies, you are only going to see the reading rooms. It's not like going into the New York Public Library where you can actually walk upstairs and go into the stacks and see the books, or like here at King's College. All the good stuff is behind closed doors. So it's been a practice of mine to take a student behind the closed doors, go upstairs into the archival rooms, open up those archival boxes, give them white gloves to put on, and then touch 250-year-old paper. And generally, you can tell which student's going, wow, I'm touching something incredibly old, and the other kid who's still thinking about baseball. But showing them the actual materials, I think, gives them almost a reverence for the archive. There's nothing reverent about Google. And this is, I think it's the best way to teach kids is to show them the real things. So I remember when I was a kid, when I went down to Washington, D.C. and went to the Smithsonian and the National Archives and actually saw behind glass the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, I got goosebumps. And I don't know if you do this today, but when you go to Philadelphia, you can touch the Liberty Bell. I think that's just a beautiful thing.
One student who approached this project with a lot of seriousness and really got into looking at original documents was Angela Lopez, who wrote a piece called From Wilkes-Barre to Gettysburg, Edmund Lovell Dana.
Edmund Dana's diary is wrapped up in a creased white envelope, tucked away in a musty file box on the second floor of a small archive house. It's 150 years old, this diary, and has held up remarkably well considering. The binding is long since broken, pages coming loose, but every narrow, cramped word is still dark and discernible. The words, like the diary they're written in, are a kind of treasure, a tale of times long past, waiting to be discovered again. Edmund Dana was born in 1817 in the Wilkes-Barre area, one of 14 children by two different mothers, and went on to have a long military career, eventually attaining the rank of general before his death in 1889. Before Dana was a general, though, he was a colonel with the Union Army who fought at Gettysburg, one of the most important battles of the American Civil War. Tuesday, June 30th, 1863. Strange how we don't think of battles in terms of days of the week, only as dates and months and years. We think little of weather or health or smaller details, only remembering the numbers and the outcome. In the morning, moved to or near Marsh Creek, about 4 miles in severe rain, was taken quite ill, but with much difficulty obtained from an old German woman permission to sleep in a bed in her home. A reader knows what will come the next day, but Dana did not, and only ended the day's entry in his diary with one last note, almost as an afterthought. Rumors that the enemy is near. Wednesday, July 1st. To us, over 150 years later, the word Gettysburg represents so much. A presidential speech, a victorious battle, a triumph of right. But in Dana's hand, it is only the name of a town that citizens are fleeing even as his regiment approaches, with the sound of artillery fire filling the air. The enemy, in numbers much greater than our own, advanced, and an engagement opened at 12:15 p.m. There is no description of glorious war here, only tactical recollections that, unadorned by adjectives, seem detached. But the images they conjure are still perfectly clear. With two other colonels wounded, Dana was forced to take command of the brigade. Fragments of the 11th Corps joined them on Cemetery Ridge, where they spent the first of several nights sleeping on the ground, with no shelter or blankets to keep off the rain. Thursday, July 2nd. A quiet day in wartime is a curious thought, so at odds with the overall struggle of life and death. But the second day of Gettysburg did dawn quiet for Dana's brigade, until noontime when the enemy came in force. Charge after charge they made, and man after man fell. Night came on, and the brigade took position for another night outside. Only this time, Dana's note is different. Slept that night amongst dead and wounded, he wrote, amongst corpses that had once been his men. himself for the moment, living and breathing and safe. Friday, July 3rd. What had until this point seemed to be a workday war, fight during the day and sleep at night, was broken by severe fire in the hours before dawn. Union soldiers brought all their guns to bear on the enemy. The roar was terrific, Dana wrote. No separate report could be heard, simply a continuous roar. Dana and his men spent most of their day flat on the ground, avoiding fire and exploding caissons until late afternoon, when the enemy amassed a blow on the Union line. It was, as a modern reader knows, for nothing, ending with many Confederates taken captive, while the rest lay, lifeless, where they had fallen. Saturday, July 4th, and Sunday, July 5th. Having survived the battle, Dana and his men took in the aftermath. In movies or books, characters that the audience emphasizes with are often killed off, to wring hearts or advance the plot, or both. It's not like that in real life, though, where friends and good men die for no other reason than that they were in the line of fire, and it was not their lucky day. One of the men found the body of a Captain Flagg, to whom Dana had lent a field glass, his side cut open, arm shot off. Dana picked up the broken glass and slipped it in his pocket. In the afternoon, rode with Lieutenant Collings and others to Gettysburg and went over and around the different positions occupied by my brigade on the 1st July. The ground still strewn with the bloated, blackened, and unrecognizable corpses of my men. It is perhaps one of the most terrific images of Dana's diary, one that any war veteran would recognize. The consequence of living, having to see what happened to those who did not. A detail got to work digging graves while Dana visited his wounded. And the next day, the war kept on. I went into this project without many expectations, but what I learned has amazed me. Every American knows about Gettysburg. They know the major players and, of course, the outcome. But there are thousands of untold stories surrounding the battle and the war. By fighting anonymous skirmishes and coming out alive, a man from a small northeastern Pennsylvania valley contributed to a victory that was, he wrote, said to be the most desperate fight of the war, probably of the century.
That was Angela Lopez with her piece on Edmund Dana. You're listening to a special edition of Off the Page here at Radio King's College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Noreen O'Connor. Off the Page is a program which allows King's College students to bring their stories to the radio. For this program, students in the professional writing program in the English department at King's College visited the Luzerne County Historical Society archives, and they brought back some really interesting stories. Our show today is in three parts. Part two is C. Edgar Patience by Tom Bubble.
C. Edgar Patience's family home in West Pittston is just a few steps from my own. Harold Patience still lives there. We wave in greeting as one of us drives by the other's residence. But I was not aware of his uncle's achievement in the art world until now. Notice I say achievement and not fame, for as much as C. Edgar Patience's work was world-renowned, in possession of 7 presidents of the United States, and earning places in the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., it does not appear that he was very famous. A Google search of his name returns the usual 4 million results, but by page 5, results are things like a Florida dentist whose name is C. Edgar. Most of the 5 pages of results relating to him are from King's College, Wilkes University, the Anthracite Heritage Museum in Scranton, and various genealogy sites. In other words, mostly local. There's not much information available about him. All I found in doing my research was a fairly slight biography written by his daughter and some old newspaper clippings announcing his exhibits. He was featured in a 4-page spread in Ebony Magazine in 1970, where he was described as America's most unusual sculptor. But almost everything written is about the art, not the man. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the recipient of a gift of anthracite sculpture created by C. Edgar Patience. Joseph Semenoff, honorary ambassador of goodwill to Holland, presented Queen Juliana of the Netherlands with a coal sculpture and a black pearl necklace made of smooth, highly polished beads of anthracite created by Patience. Wyoming Valley in northeastern Pennsylvania is a place rich in history. And what is history but the story of a people? Our valley was settled before the American Revolution and has been home to repeated waves of immigrants seeking a better life in America. These new Americans, seeking safety in numbers from those who came before, tended to settle in the same neighborhoods and towns. To this day, Pittston is still considered Italian, Avoca is considered Irish, and DuPont, Polish. Growing up in West Pittston in the early 60s, there was no doubt that my hometown was dominated by white Protestants of Welsh descent. To this day, there are 5 Protestant houses of worship in West Pittston, and only 1 Catholic church. That lonely Catholic church is literally on the other side of the tracks, having been built on the west side of the railroad tracks to bisect the town and separates West Pittston's grand Victorian homes from its more humble dwellings. Wendell Willkie, who ran for president against FDR in 1940, received an anthracite coal gift carved by C. Edgar Patience. Upon winning its independence from Great Britain in 1966, the new prime minister of the island of Barbados commissioned C. Edgar to fashion the new seal of the fledgling Caribbean nation out of Pennsylvania anthracite. A friend of my parents, who was of Italian heritage, told a funny but telling story relating to the purchase of his house in the late 50s. He bought a beautiful old Victorian-style home on Susquehanna Avenue in West Pittston. Susquehanna Avenue faces the river. It is lined with majestic shade trees and is the location of the town's century-plus-age mansions. Word got back to our family friend that a conversation was overheard between two old widows who had lived on the same street. They were expressing their concern over what they were going to do since an Italian Catholic had bought a home on Susquehanna Avenue and that it would surely lead to the end of the neighborhood. President Harry Truman was presented with a gift of C. Edgar Patience's coal art. George Marvin Pollard, consul of the United States in Munich, expressed interest in C. Edgar's work and commissioned some pieces to be used as gifts for the Germans. Even being all white, racism was alive and well in my town when I was growing up, and I regularly heard all of the common ethnic slurs. Kike, Dago, Mick, Polak, Spick, Roundheader, and yes, nigger. Black people were so rare in Wyoming Valley in the early 60s that I can remember as a little boy turning and pointing out a black man to my mother on a shopping trip to Wilkes-Barre. Black people here were that rare then. But in spite of the bigotry in northeastern Pennsylvania and my hometown, the only black family living in West Pittston in the early 60s was treated with universal respect. They were the Patience family. I never thought about their race. They were just the Patiences. I knew Harold Patience, who was about a decade older than me, and still lives in the family homestead around the corner. I went to grade school with Jackie Claiborne, whose mother's name was Patience. I never thought of them as anything but just Harold and Jackie. What I didn't know was that their uncle, C. Edgar Patience, was by this time an artist whose work was owned by presidents and princesses, sculpted from the native northeastern Pennsylvania medium of anthracite coal. President Dwight Eisenhower owned an anthracite sculpture of C. Edgar Patience. A couple of symbols of American business were immortalized by C. Edgar's hands. A 41-pound replica of a Hoover Model 1800 vacuum cleaner was commissioned by the Hoover Corporation for display at its headquarters in Canton, Ohio. Likewise, the Mack Truck Corporation commissioned a likeness of its iconic bulldog for display at its corporate headquarters in Allentown, Pennsylvania. C. Edgar's story starts with Crowder Patience, who at 18 years of age was an escaped slave who joined the 103rd Infantry Regiment of the Union Army. Joining up in North Carolina in 1864, Crowder fought on the side of the North in the American Civil War. He mustered out of the Army in Harrisburg and eventually settled in West Pittston in 1877. He had 8 children. One of Crowder's sons, Harry, had 7 sons himself. One of those 7 sons was C. Edgar Patience. Crowder's son, Harry, was a breaker boy, a youth who worked picking rock and slate out of freshly mined coal at the Exeter Colliery. A common pastime of breaker boys was to whittle small pieces of coal into various objects. Harry got quite good at carving coal trinkets and eventually formed a coal novelty souvenir business with his brother, Chester. They created ashtrays and key fobs and harp-shaped lockets, all out of Pennsylvania anthracite. All of Harry's sons learned their father's trade and worked in the family business, but one by one, they all took other jobs. All except C. Edgar. President John F. Kennedy was not only given a piece of C. Edgar Patience's artwork, but was immortalized in anthracite himself in one of Patience's most famous works, a life-size bust of JFK fashioned from a single piece of coal. At the American Folk Heritage Display at the Montreal Expo in 1967, Prime Minister of Canada, Lester Pearson, paid a personal visit to C. Edgar Patience at a display of his work. Over time, C. Edgar tired of the anthracite trinket trade and longed to be a true artist to give full vent to his creative expression in the black medium he loved. Even though he had his first exhibit at the Osterhout Library in Wilkes-Barre in 1938, it was not until his marriage in 1948 that his opportunity arrived to be a professional sculptor. Edgar's wife, Alice Marie Patterson, was a graduate of Bennett College in North Carolina and Scranton University. She was the first African-American manager of the Blue Cross Information Center in Wilkes-Barre and provided their family's income, allowing C. Edgar to pursue his art full-time. In 1964, C. Edgar Patience received a letter from President Lyndon Johnson's wife and First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, in which she wrote, in reference to a set of anthracite bookends C. Edgar had created, They are already placed in a special place in our room. In 1972, he was featured in Who's Who in America. In 1954, because King's College bought its main building from the Lehigh Valley Coal Company, the president of King's College, Reverend Leo Flood, CSC, wished to do something to illustrate the bond between the new college and the coal heritage of the Wyoming Valley. To fulfill this wish, the Corgan family commissioned C. Edgar to create a 4,200-pound altar made of a solid piece of anthracite. The altar is still in an alcove in the rear of the Chapel of Christ the King on King's campus, and in 1957 was featured in the popular newspaper feature, Ripley's Believe It or Not. The October 23, 1995 edition of Monarch Notes states, "It was carved by the late Edgar Patience, whose worldwide reputation as a master carver earned his work a place in New York's Metropolitan Museum and others around the world." President Richard Nixon was presented with a piece of coal art created by C. Edgar Patience. In C. Edgar's biography, there is a photo of First Lady Pat Nixon chatting with C. Edgar as she admires some of his work. President Jimmy Carter was presented with a work of art carved by C. Edgar Patience. Success as a recognized artist came to Patience in the late 1960s, and by then, collectors began to buy his works and his art could be found internationally. In 1961, a hall of anthracite was planned to memorialize and celebrate the natural resource that fueled the industrialization of America. The exhibit space was planned to be built in Washington, D.C. Patience was commissioned to create an ambitious piece of art weighing 3.5 tons to be part of the exhibit, but the hall was never fully funded and was never built. Patience completed the work, and it is still in storage at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. C. Edgar Patience died in 1972, ironically from anthracillosis. It is a disease peculiar to coal miners, commonly referred to as black lung disease, a disease caused by prolonged inhalation of coal dust. The medium he loved to work in so much was what ultimately killed him. If in the end his success failed to bring him fame, one thing it did seem to bring him was happiness. In his biography and clippings, there are many photos of him and his craft. Most of them candid, and what I noticed was how contented and serene he looks in each of those photos. Juanita Patience Moss wrote in her biography of her father that he loved talking about his art and his medium, coal. She said he would take the time to answer in detail any question asked of him about his art. That, in my estimation, is a symptom of a man happy with how he is spending his life. And that truly is a man, if not of fame, of achievement.
That was Tom Bubble with his profile of C. Edgar Patience. You're listening to a special edition of Off the Page today on Radio King's College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Students from the professional writing program here in the English department at King's College had a chance to visit the Luzerne County Historical Society archives, and they brought back some really interesting stories. Today's show is in three parts, and part three is Patricia Streeter's piece, Daniel Hart, the Clever Politician.
The Roaring Twenties marked the time of one of Wilkes-Barre's most loved and controversial mayors, Daniel L. Hart. Though he was an Irish Democrat in a Welsh conservative town, a Democrat politician was able to hold office from 1920 until the day he died in office, 1933. Usually the most popular party wins elections. However, Daniel L. Hart defeated his Republican counterpart 3 times. His success was noticed by President Roosevelt after he won his 3rd election. President Roosevelt promptly called and congratulated him. Given the state of the nation was in during the 30s, a call from the president is quite remarkable. Daniel L. Hart's political career is peculiar and intriguing. Thus, it seems fitting to investigate a man simply known as the Man from Wilkes-Barre. Of course, he cannot be questioned today. However, he has left his mark in the city as well as Luzerne County's Historical Society's Research Library Archives. Back in 1915, while Hart was the city treasurer, he remodeled his home to resemble a southern mansion. With its massive size and 4 pillars, it caught the attention of local newspapers. According to the Wilkes-Barre Record, it was Hart's boyhood dream to remodel his home. As a boy, he had cut pictures of images he wanted his home to look like. 30 years later, he made his dreams a reality. The home was originally built by his father 4 years before he was born. It had served as the tax collector of Hanover Township, D.L. O'Neill's tax office for many years. Surprisingly, Hart kept most of the interior the same.
His primary focus was changing the exterior. For me, the home is a reflection of Daniel L. Hart's journey. Though he had gained success across the country and his career, he had stayed the same. He did not forget his roots. Staying true to his father's background, Daniel L. Hart is one of the few politicians that helped negotiate the Pennsylvania coal strikes. Being the son of a coal miner and becoming mayor after the devastating mining accident in 1919, it was crucial that the negotiations were handled with the utmost care. I believe he was able to place himself in the shoes of the widows and the fatherless children, because many of them were Irish. If this occurred when he was a boy, his family would have suffered because his father was the breadwinner. As a result, the mining community had a lot of respect for Hart. Hart's remodeled home was more than aesthetically pleasing. It had played a key role in his administration. During his time in office, the Hart Mansion served as his administration headquarters. In addition, Hart had his own speakeasy. The third floor of Hart's home was fondly known as Club de Attique. Normally, having a small bar in your home was not frowned upon. However, Hart was mayor during Prohibition. The cops were raiding Luzerne County homes for breweries. Wilkes-Barre is known for its lax support and enforcement of Prohibition. Also, the chance of him being arrested and sent to court over this was very unlikely because police officers were regulars at Club de Attique. The club was not the only reason the police stayed off his back about the speakeasy. Hart had done for the police what he did for the miners. He worked to resolve issues in the police department. For one, hours were shortened. Though hours were decreased, wages increased with guaranteed annual vacations. Also, the force received new, efficient uniforms. Looking from the present-day perspective, I would assume these people were entitled to these additions. However, there was a time when Americans worked long, strenuous hours with inadequate pay. Vacations were not something common men enjoyed prior to the 20s. In essence, why would the force want to ruin its good relationship with Mayor Hart over a speakeasy? I believe they would not for two reasons. One, Hart was a good, charismatic mayor. And two, most of the city was against Prohibition. As a matter of fact, every year they would petition to increase the percentage of alcohol people and businesses were allowed to purchase. Since many were not in favor of Prohibition, Club de Attique became a haven for socialites to indulge and converse amongst the elite. According to the Sunday paper of May 29, 1966, Hart's mansion was the place to be. From 1920 to 1933, Club de Attique hosted socialites as well as politicians. Since Wilkes-Barre was nationally known as one of the top locations for vaudeville, top actors were given special treatment at Club de Attique. Daniel L. Hart's theatrical career, transforming his home into a mansion and creating a sophisticated, exclusive speakeasy, turned him into a celebrity. His fame alone was not enough to get him reelected three times. Daniel L. Hart was not only a wonderful playwright and beloved politician. Through the course of his life, he was a member of several professional and social clubs in and outside of the northeastern Pennsylvania. During his life, Hart was elected president of two international organizations, which were League of Press Clubs and the Fraternal Order of the Eagles, Alabama. In addition, he functioned as the president of Leaders of Third Class Cities of Pennsylvania. All three were able to spread his name across the nation. Back home, he was a member of many social clubs. Hart was a lifelong member of Wilkes-Barre Lodge No. 109, the Knights of Columbus, the Alabama Club, and many more. I believe the social clubs made him the most popular mayor in Wilkes-Barre history because he was a part of the community. He was a man that could take care of business and have a chat with you in front of an open fire. His diverse relationship with the community allowed him to make himself the it mayor. To be known across the nation as the man from Wilkes-Barre is an accomplishment. Since he was born in Wilkes-Barre, his success and fame pertains to the city as well. It is as if the city itself is saying, "That's our boy." This love for Daniel L. Hart completely justifies the city's reaction to his death on February 2, 1933. Based on the flood of articles I read about Mayor Hart, he was the city's celebrity. Column after column, the Wilkes-Barre Record on February 3, 1933, was about Hart. To me, If the columns did not pertain to Hart, they seemed awkward and out of place. Generally, if it wasn't about his funeral, the paper covered the actions of Wilkes-Barre's acting mayor, Joseph G. Schuller. Overall, he took front page and many columns throughout local newspapers. There are many columns that could be used to show the city's love, but this simple stanza from a poem that was published in 1933 says it all. Well, here is time of parting, but it's hard to say goodbye. The world seems all too fragile to support our weight of woe. No language could be telling just how full our hearts of welling with consciousness of knowing that you are really have to go. But Danny boy, the world is just a stage. You played your part, and over there, as here, the critics bound to call it good. It's sadly out we send you, but my happy fate attend you. We kept you in our hearts, old friend, as long as neighbors could. To say this man meant nothing to the city of Wilkes-Barre would be a false statement. In addition, the word Danny Boy refers to the unofficial anthem of the Irish-American community. Not only is this a loss to the city of Wilkes-Barre, his death was devastating to Irish immigrants. Because he was Irish first-generation American, it is important to note immigrants, specifically Italians and Irish, were not well received during the 20th century. His life showcased that the talent and leadership capabilities of the Irish community. On a bright note, the city still had the Hart Mansion, where they could remember his legacy. Unfortunately, on May 29, 1966, the Sunday paper had this headline: Mayor Hart Mansion will be razed for modern drive-in restaurant. Though Hart left the mansion to his brother, it had seen many owners before its demise. After 3 decades of attempting to make it into a restaurant, the final owner, Joseph Campanella, put it up for sale. Sadly, this was a loss to the community and the city. Hart's life and political career was deeply rooted in this mansion. With it came volumes of stories. Unfortunately, Daniel L. Hart's home was removed from Hazel Street. One fact is certain. Those of the Roaring Twenties will remember 468 Hazel Street. However, this is not enough. As generations meet their maker, they take their stories with them. Though Daniel L. Hart is preserved at the Luzerne County Historical Society Research Library Archive, most people do not know about his political career or Club the Attic. In my opinion, Daniel L. Hart has a unique and colorful story that should be shared and remembered. As long as archives continue to preserve and locate information on leaders such as Daniel L. Hart, present man will appreciate the past and apply it to their future. I've learned a lot from Hart. I have the Luzerne County Historical Society to thank for that. If it was not for their hard work, I would not know about the man from Wilkes-Barre today.
That was Patricia Streeter with Daniel Hart, the Clever Politician. You've been listening to Off the Page today. Thank you for listening. This is Noreen O'Connor, and I've been your host. I would like to thank Sarah Cinto, who did the production today for all of the student recordings, and Sue Henry, who helped me put together the whole program and did the final production. Please keep listening to WRKC. We'll be bringing you some more stories from the Luzerne County Historical Society archives, as well as more of my interview with Tony Brooks in a few weeks.
Thank you for listening to Off the Page on WRKC Wilkes-Barre, Radio King's College.